Orlando, 126-117. The Bulls were off. Tonight, the Bucks are off. The Bulls play in Memphis. NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They play in Winnipeg tonight. College basketball, NIT, first-round action. Marquette beat Harvard 67-60 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana last night. Marquette now moves on to play Oregon on Sunday afternoon. The forecast from the National Weather Service, today sunny and seasonal, a high of 43. 23 tonight, sunny and 39 for Friday. This morning, the sun is shining, 28 degrees Racine, 29 Kenosha at 10 past 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea. For over 100 years, Jack's has been celebrating spring with the finest in Easter treats, from their famous pectin jelly beans to solid milk and dark chocolate bunnies. Let them assemble the perfect Easter baskets for your loved ones. JackAndrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited indeed about the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show. And I want to begin by evoking a name that will mean a lot to a lot of you who are listening right now, the name of Aldo Leopold, the great naturalist and author of, among other things, A Sand County Almanac and other books that spoke so eloquently about the natural world around us and the importance of us living carefully and sensitively on this precious earth. It so happens that my Morning Show guest today, Scott Freeman, is married to the granddaughter of Aldo Leopold, Susan Leopold Freeman. And Scott Freeman, a native of Wisconsin himself, is someone who has worked extensively in the field of conservation and the environment. In fact, receiving his evolutionary biology, a PhD at the University of Washington. He and his wife now make their home in Washington State, having purchased some land there and having decided to do what they could to help restore a damaged creek. And the story of that is told in this beautiful new book written by Scott Freeman called Saving Tarboo Creek: One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. But the book, beyond that story, is also set against the wider landscape of how all of us collectively are viewing the earth as something to be consumed in a way that is really quite alarming. And it is a call for us to stop and reconsider the way that we regard the earth around us and its creatures. It's a moving book and also full of all kinds of really fascinating information. And the beautiful illustrations in this book are by Susan Leopold Freeman. Again, the book is Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land, published by Timber Press. And Scott Freeman, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Great to be here.
I'm glad to be talking with you. I sketched only the barest outlines of your own life. I wonder if you could kind of fill in some of the gaps, if you would, please. I know from your biography that you actually grew up in or around Beloit. Tell us more about your formative years here in Wisconsin, and also be sure to include when you met Susan.
Yeah, sure will. Yeah, Beloit was a great place to grow up, and I still have family, lots of family in Wisconsin. But Susan and I actually met at the Aldo Leopold Memorial Reserve near Baraboo in Sauk County, Wisconsin. That was 1980, and we both had summer jobs working at the principal within the called the Alba Leopold Memorial Reserve. I was doing some land restoration work and some education projects with local landowners, and Susan had just graduated from the Art Institute in Chicago, and she had a fellowship to paint for the summer. So we met each other there, and the life eventually took us out to the Pacific Northwest and to raise a family and start our professional lives. We still have very deep roots in Wisconsin.
Very good. Explain to our listeners about this move to Washington State. What precipitated that, and specifically, what precipitated the purchase of the particular land around which much of your book is focused?
Well, our move from Wisconsin out to the Northwest was actually for graduate school, and then work kept us out here. But the idea for us, a dream of working on a habitat restoration project, really started that summer in central Wisconsin in Sauk County, where we were at the Leopold land that as you mentioned, had been really went back to 1935 when Alba Leopold bought a Dust Bowl farm and started what was the first, it's my understanding, the first ever in history attempt at ecological restoration. So the family and friends worked for about 12 years before Alba's death to bring back prairie plants and plant pine trees that had been eliminated from the area. And actually, it took what was a just beaten up, abused area and created what now is an absolute jewel. So Susan and I met at that place, which was now a jewel, and thought, wouldn't it be wonderful as a family and with friends and larger community to do a project like that? And so when we were settled in the Pacific Northwest, we started looking for a project like that, and in 2004 we found Tarboo Creek.
And hence a beautiful story that we'll explore in some detail in just a moment. I want to step back into kind of the larger picture, if we could for a moment. And actually, it's one of the things that's especially intriguing about your book is that on the one hand, it is the story of this one creek and your efforts to restore it and the woodlands around it and so on. But you also are telling this, in a sense, more intimate and personal story against a much larger backdrop, sort of the context of our planet as a whole, and we as human beings, and this moment in our history. And I love that sense of both kind of the sprawling epic canvas and yet this very intimate story of your own family as well. From the start, was that always your intention to write this book with, in a sense, those parallel stories both in place?
Yes, exactly. You just nailed what was in my mind about the structure of this book. And that actually grew out of teaching I do. So I teach biology at the University of Washington, and often to get these, you know, great, gigantic introductory biology courses with hundreds and hundreds of students in a lecture hall. And I have the students look at a lot of data sets and wrestle and talk to each other and think and discuss as a big class. And in the last couple weeks of the course that I often teach in the fall, we get to the section on ecology, and so we go through data on projections of human population growth, and these are to 2100. So these are, you know, over the next 80 years or so. So this is my students' life and their children and certainly their grandchildren, and then we look at data on whether mass extinction is going on right now, and data on projections for climate change and already the changes we're seeing in ocean chemistry and the implications for our local shellfish industry in the Northwest, or for the frequency of forest fires, intensity of hurricanes and all that. And I don't do any preaching, any editorializing at all. I just show them the data. This is just sort of a view of the world that they have to grasp as young scientists and young citizens. And it hits them like a ton of bricks. As you said, this global canvas is all of a sudden, you know, they're 17, 18 years old. They're trying to figure out sort of who am I as an adult and how do I make my way in the world. And here they're looking at what the world looks like and thinking, my goodness, you know, what are we walking into here? So that can be emotionally and intellectually really tough for young people. And so I think that's an important story to put out. But at the same time, as you said, interweave, you know what? Things have been bad in the past as a species and as smaller communities. We faced enormous challenges from World War II to the Civil Rights Movement. And when people get together and decide we need to change things and roll up our sleeves, and in our case, it's rolling up our sleeves along this little creek called Tarboo Creek and start working together, just amazing things can happen. And not only to, in our case, the land. We were out planting trees yesterday with a group of friends and family and neighbors. But good things happen to each other. You know, we have a real community now because of people who have engaged in making a Buse place a lot better.
Hmm. I wonder if you could explain the book's very intriguing dedication, which is focused in particular on your father-in-law, Carl Leopold. So that would be Aldo Leopold's son. That in and of itself is not so much of a surprise. But I think the way this dedication is shaped and its focus is actually a little bit of a surprise, particularly at first glance. Can you explain the book's dedication and what is behind it?
Well, I was thinking about Carl Leopold's life. So this is my wife's dad, my father-in-law, and one of the most remarkable human beings I've ever had the joy to meet and connect with. But I was thinking when he was, I think he was 20 years old, when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and he was starting college and trying to think about starting a career. And all of a sudden, he and millions of other young men and women his age realized we have to fight a war. And we, for a lot of us, we won't survive it, but we have to do this. And I was just talking a minute ago about the students in my class thinking there's a mass extinction going on. The climate could be turned upside down in our lifetime. And I was thinking of those young 18, 19, 20-year-old young men and women in 1941 thinking, you know, I didn't ask for this. What happened to the world? Why? And that the students in my classroom have to have some of the same emotions. Like, we didn't ask for a world like this. What happened? But at the same time, there is this, it's really, to me, in my heart, a call that, all right, we didn't ask for this, but we have to act. We have to do this. And in World War II, the dedication was to those young men and women and the larger community that supported them, who did rise up and defeat fascism and totalitarianism, which at the time was far and away the greatest threat to not only freedom and democracy, but just human integrity and quality of life. So I'm thinking we have a little bit of a parallel challenge right now in, as you said, in what people sort of glibly call the environmental crisis, but we have a planet to take care of, and that's sort of what we need to rise up and respond to right now.
Hmm. You end that dedication by saying, today, 75 years after the Second World War began, a global conflagration, high school and college students are again being called on to save the world. This book is dedicated to them, too. I really appreciate also the introduction to the book, which is titled, in deceptively simple fashion, Noticing Things. And it begins with a lovely story about your uncle, a gentleman by the name of Carl Holtz from somewhere here in southeastern Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Explain this story and what makes this such a great starting point for your lovely book.
Well, my Uncle Carl was, you're right, he grew up just south of Milwaukee, knows your neck of the woods very, very well. He farmed all his life. And I remember visiting him one time, and after Susan and I were married, and so we were connected to the Leopold family, and he told me a story. He was taking the short course for farmers at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he said he was in Alma Leopold's Wildlife for Farmers class, and he said he was a my Uncle Carl was actually famous. He's in the Hall of Fame for rowing, collegiate rowing. He rowed at UW. So he said, you know, I was a jock, and here I was in Professor Leopold's class, and there was a one-on-one interview as part of the class. All the students had to come in and have a short conversation with Professor Leopold. And my uncle said, well, I went in for mine, and I was sitting there sort of, you know, being a dumb jock, and Leopold was sort of sizing me up. And at one point he looked out the window and he said, Carl, what bird is that? And my uncle can just see his face. He just started laughing. I had absolutely no idea. But then he got serious and he realized, he connected. He understood what Leopold was trying to do. And he said, you know, Carl, you're going to be out farming, which means you're going to be taking care of some land, and that's an important job you've dedicated your life to. And I want you, while you're out farming and working that land, to notice things about it. And it might be a bird flying by. And my uncle, you know, he told that story to me 40 years later, and he was still noticing things. And he actually, before he retired and before he died, he actually had a strip of land along a creek at the, in their literally their back 40 of their farm near McGuanago, and he put a conservation easement on it, and he was planting trees and bringing habitat back for cranes and the wetland creatures back there. So that little conversation that I mentioned in the intro really changed his life in a profound way, and I think in ways that he really enjoyed.
Hmm. And you go on to say, just after you've talked about your uncle, this book is about small things, like watching birds brighten a February afternoon or hearing a tree frog on a cold, moonless night, about planting a tree or hoeing beans. But it's also about a big thing, what life will be like in 2100 when the human population passes 11 billion and almost half of the species alive today are extinct. You go on to say something that I think is so intriguing about the 20th century, which we have, from which we have just emerged into the 21st century. I think you do a really wonderful job of putting the 20th century into context as a time in which certainly there were a couple of more than a couple of really terrible conflicts that exacted quite a painful price, but also a time in which there was all kinds of human flourishing in many different ways. But then you tell us that, in a sense, that flourishing comes at a cost, and that is what the real challenge now is for us in the 21st century. Explain what you're talking about there.
Well, that is my view, and many others. This thought certainly isn't original with me, but the idea that what happened over that 100-year period was, as you say, a time of tremendous political and civil conflict, but tremendous gains in the spread of democracy and freedom and alleviation of poverty, global poverty that is continuing today. You know, amazing technological progress, scientific progress, and medical progress, the quality of life. We don't have to worry now when our kids start a cough that they are going to be dead from diphtheria or TB in a couple of days. Those kinds of things have transformed human life. But on the other hand, the costs from those benefits has been what I see, and I think many others of us, as a culture of excess that that scientific and medical and technological and sort of consumer-driven progress has a downside, and it is, I think, a matter of excess, that a lot of the issues we're facing now, from the obesity epidemic to the opiate epidemic and what's happening to our landscape around us, is being driven by some of those successes, that we just have the capacity to have a lot of stuff and try to organize our lives around the value of having stuff. We're constantly bombarded with messages that say, well, you know, if you're really going to be cool, if you're going to be a good person, you need a great big house, you need a great big car, and a great big TV set. And, you know, fundamentally, that's not working for people individually and as a collective. So a lot of the problems we're facing today, I think, are sort of the echo of, again, that amazing progress. But we have to deal with the consequences now.
Hmm. So, of course, this is a big part of what your book is about, and that will usher us nicely in a moment into the story of this beautiful creek that you and your wife have worked so hard to restore. You write, "Saving Tarboo Creek is written for that thinking community, for the network of people across the globe from all walks of life and every possible background who live a thoughtful, examined life. An examined life pursues wisdom. It is mindful of the needs of others. It is a life worth living." I'm reminded at that point of something you say much later in the book about how human beings, for some reason, tend to gravitate towards dichotomies, and in most cases, rather simplistic dichotomies. In fact, maybe inherently dichotomies are simplistic. And you really caution us to resist that temptation, and particularly when it comes to some of the matters that you take up in this book. Explain a little further what you're talking about, our love of dichotomies, and what a problem that can be when we are maybe confronted with choices that we have to make about our own lives and our communities and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is a natural human tendency, and we see it all over from, you know, we're talking about human personalities or people in our lives, and say, oh, he's type A or he's type B, or in politics, you know, we're polarized to extreme left and extreme right, or people who aren't thinking very carefully will start ranting about, if we have environmental regulation, we'll shut down the economy, or if we have economic growth, then of course we're going to destroy the planet. And in reality, people who are careful about what they're doing and pursuing, whether it be good corporate or public policy, we really make progress when we cut that out, when we quit thinking about eithers and ors and start thinking about ands. So, for example, in our local level, in our county, in Jefferson County, it's a very rural county in where Tarbell Creek is, and there's a wonderful movement of often young families, 20-somethings, who are going out and starting small-scale agriculture, and so there's this wonderful economic redevelopment going on in what was a depressed rural area, with these really vital businesses and creative people starting, and you know, music and culture is happening, so that economic well-being is transforming this area. But at the same time, these folks are really concerned about the way they're farming and the quality of the soils and, in many cases, the creeks running through their land. So I just don't see those kinds of dichotomies if you're really living in a thoughtful way.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Scott Freeman, and we are talking about his book, Saving Tarbell Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. So let's talk about this little spot, not so little, but certainly a beautiful spot that you and your wife purchased, I believe, back in 2004. Describe to us Tarbell Creek, and in particular, describe its state when you purchased it.
Oh, that's easy. It was an absolute mess. Oh my goodness. I mean, my wife and I have done projects, you know, we worked on houses that were in bad shape or helped friends get through tough spots. And so we've done projects before, and we were looking for one. We wanted to find some land that had been beaten up and make it better. But we weren't quite sure we were up to the task. When we first saw Tarbell Creek, the area that was available for us to purchase was the worst stretch of this little stream. And it is little. It's only about 7.5 miles long, flows into the Pacific Ocean. But the area had been ditched. So the forest, the old growth forest, had been cleared back in the 1880s, 1890s, and the area had been farmed, but the soils were very poor, so most of the farms had been abandoned. The businesses weren't viable. So these ditches were still intact, and the stream was eroding. Like for the first time we went out there, a friend of ours was with us, and she hopped down into the ditch, and she couldn't see out. She and the creek were literally 6 feet under. So it was in rough shape, and it was covered with, a lot of your listeners will know, reed canary grass. That's a famous invasive that takes over wet soils. That was just forming a carpet in areas, and there was another really notorious actor out here called Himalayan blackberry that had taken over our swath. So, yeah, it was in rough shape when we got started.
Hmm. So you weren't alone. Tell us about this community of individuals and organizations that were working on this region of Washington, and in a sense, what kind of a community it was and what it was like to be part of it.
Well, that's one of the reasons we were attracted to the Tarbell Creek area to begin with, but we were looking at different projects around Washington State that were close enough to our home that we could manage being engaged. But one of the things about the Tarbell Creek project is that things were just getting started. There was a little organization called Northwest Watershed Institute, and they had visions and other organizations in the community had visions for making this sort of a model of working on an entire watershed and that had been beat up, and trying to see if we can get together with a lot of different resources and tribes and state and federal and county agencies and local nonprofits and neighbors and landowners, and really work on this over the long term. And we thought, well, if we could play a little bit of a part in that bigger scheme, that could be just a lot of fun. And that's actually what's transpired. Our land was one of the first projects, but it's really grown from there. There were, I think, 400 school kids out planting trees in the watershed just last week. And I think over, now what we're on year 14, year 15 maybe of the really active work, and I think over 3,000 acres have been protected in the watershed. And a variety of landowners have put conservation easements on the parts of the creek that flow through their property. And so it's been one of the great joys, is getting connected with friends and neighbors and doing the work as a group.
You tell us that under normal circumstances, when somebody buys land, it really makes sense to wait maybe 4 or 5 years before embarking on any significant restoration projects, because typically it's a good idea to really get to know the land and come to a really profound understanding of what needs to be done and the best way to do it. But you tell us that really wasn't possible in this case. You needed to get to work right away.
That's right. That was actually advice I got from a guy who taught at UW-Madison named Jim Zimmerman. wait 5 years and really get to know the land. But when we bought it, that this conservation group I mentioned had a little grant, a little pot of money to hire a guy with an excavator to come in and get the creek out of that ditch. And so that happened within months of us purchasing it. So we were still trying to find, you know, which way's north on this property we just purchased, when, you know, sure enough, here's the excavator, and we're going to have a new creek bed. So things started happening really fast. The big move was that first summer in 2004. And Sue's dad came out, and her aunt Estella, one of Aldo and Stella's daughters, were out. So we had a bunch of family out there helping, and with the excavator and our team working around it, we were able to get the creek out of the ditch into a much more natural sort of meandering stream bed. And then we started planting trees, and the project just went from there.
I want you to explain a line in this chapter, which is called "A Stream Is Born." You write, "The purpose of a stream restoration is to undo everything that channelization does." So explain what channelization is, or in particular, in this case, what that means or what that would look like, especially to a layperson just looking. And then what was involved in undoing that channelization?
Well, what's happened to rivers all over the world is that when people are developing an area or starting to build around it, our inclination is, well, let's control this thing. So let's put it, you know, concrete bunkers or a big dike on either side so it won't flood anymore, or let's put it in a ditch so the channelization would be digging a big straight channel. So usually, you know, rivers over decades wind all over a big floodplain and just go where the water takes it. And usually people say, no, we want to tell the river what to do. And so in agricultural areas, you know, it's very common to ditch the streams. So first they straighten out so the water's running much faster. So instead of sitting and saturating the soils, it'll run through it much faster. And so the soils tend to dry out. And then you're dropping the water down through digging the channel. So that, again, dries the soil out, which can make it possible to pasture or even plow areas near floodplains. So that's what channelization does, is basically dry the soils out, get the water off the land, and of course it degrades the habitat for the river and the fish and all the other resources that are dependent on the aquatic areas. But that's what channelization does. So when you bring in an excavator and remeander it, you're bringing the water back up toward the surface, you're getting it to wind back and forth. So like on our place, we had about 1,000 yards, I think, of creeks, and now we have 1,500. So it was actually a 50% increase in the amount of stream channel just by it looping back and forth instead of running straight. So that wets the soil, so now you get all sorts of different plants and animals coming back that need that kind of habitat. And, of course, you have much, much better habitat for fish. In our case, the real focus was trying to help the salmon come back.
Right. I think this is at least one facet, probably a very significant facet, of what you're talking about when you say, when you talk about introducing complexity into a restored salmon stream. So it sounds like there need to be, through the course of this creek, it's not just that a meandering creek looks pretty. There's something sort of picturesque about it, but there's also, in a sense, a complexity that is created when you have that versus just a straight shot of rapidly moving water.
Right. So, for example, one of the things you do, yeah, that's a really good point. One of the things you do when you it's called re-meandering a creek, is you stick, especially in the Pacific Northwest, where these creeks flow through great big forests, is that there are always trees and down woody debris dropping into the creek. So it's natural and normal for these creeks to have a lot of wood in it. And so when you re-meander, usually we pick up sort of scabby, useless logs from commercially useless logs from logging areas that are just going to be potentially thrown away, and you stick those in the creek. And so instead of the straight, you know, quote unquote clean channel that's running down a ditch, you have this not only meandering thing, but there's all sorts of tree trunks and logs, and it's rolling over spots, and it creates this sort of complexity where there are fast spots and slow spots and little pools and deep pools and deep banks and shallow banks, and all those places are, as you say, not only just pretty for us. Everybody loves to walk around it's a lot more fun to walk along a natural sort of creek than a ditch, but also there are just a lot of creatures that can live in those places. And when the salmon come back, they've got places to breathe, they've got the babies, they've got places to hang out and find things to eat, and so they do a lot better.
We're speaking with Scott Freeman about his book, Saving Tarboo Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land. Let's talk about trees and what you explore in this chapter, in which you had to decide what trees to purchase, what trees and shrubs to plant. And this is always the question that is posed to anybody, but it was a very, very tricky question. It's, in fact, you say it really is always harder than it sounds. But in particular for you, you were trying to make your choices about what trees to plant, mindful of the sobering reality of climate change. And also the fact that you were perhaps, to some extent, tempted to try to restore this landscape to what it had once been. And to what extent did that make sense? To what extent could that even be possible? Help us untie just this complicated question and how you and your wife ultimately came to sort of a resolution about it.
Well, that's a question that's actually been being debated all over the world among ecologists and people who engage in ecological restoration. And the issue is that when this work first started, for example, with the Leopold family in central Wisconsin in the 1930s, the motivating idea was, you know, that plants and animals seem to be doing really well in Wisconsin. The yard mark was the 1840s. So when European settlers first arrived and started changing conditions, that the soils were in really good shape then, and the forests were doing beautifully, and the streams and wetlands and lakes were productive and teeming with wildlife. So let's try to recreate that, what this place looked like in 1840. And that was always the yardstick. And now we're all realizing that you can't go back to 1840 because the climate has changed. There are species of plants, animals, insects, birds that have been introduced from all over the world in some cases, and so the species around you are going to be very different that didn't exist there in 1840. The climate is changing faster than it has in tens of millions of years, and so you can't go back. We have to go forward, but as you say, what does forward look like? We're looking at projections, and we're thinking, well, if present trends continue, the climatologists, and they've been very accurate up to now, they're thinking by the time our grandson is walking around Tarboo Creek, it's going to be a very different looking place. So we were out planting shrubs yesterday, and, you know, when we order our plants, we have to think, well, are we planting for now? The species that are going to be okay, given already our summers are drying out here and our winters are getting wetter, storms are getting more severe, but basically the vegetation that was here for centuries is still okay. But if that change continues, if present trends continue, they'll have to move north, and we would have to be thinking about planting things that now are native to, actually, if present trends continue, we'd have to be thinking about things that are native to the San Francisco Bay Area, which is, for your listeners, would be thinking like planting trees that are native to the Ozarks. Hmm. So we're thinking about that kind of change in a couple of generations. It's really boggling.
Right. So the question is, do we plant trees for the past or the present or for the future? And
exactly.
It sounds like what you have done, you write, at Tarbo Creek, we plant trees that will grow well now, and we work toward a future that does not depend on fossil fuels. And you
That's
hope
right.
that...
The one of the most inspirational talks I ever heard was from Bill Gates Sr. So he's Bill Gates Jr., the Microsoft founder. His dad is kind of a civic icon out here in the Northwest. And he talked about, so he's now in his early 90s and still very active in the community, but he's seen a lot over his lifespan. And he said, you know, I've seen over and over, he called it an expression of the public will. And I just love that phrase. He was talking about the civil rights movement or economic development or political challenges or world wars in the 20th century. And he said when people saw something that was bad and not a direction that they wanted their community to go, people would rise up and change the way they're voting or change the way they're conducting their lives or what they're purchasing every day. And he called that an expression of the public will. There were little examples locally here. There's a big lake in the Seattle metro area called Lake Washington, and it had gotten polluted like so many lakes across the Midwest and North America, and it was actually unsafe for swimming. Kids couldn't, on a hot summer day, couldn't swim there. It wasn't safe. They could get sick. And he saw the community just rise up and say, we don't want to live in a place like that. Let's get going. And so, you know, municipal sewage treatment plants got funded, and the lake cleaned up. So he called these movements expressions of the public will. And I'm seeing, so back to our decision about what trees to plant, I'm really feeling my bones and my heart that there's an expression of the public will that is beginning locally and globally of saying we have to take care of this planet, and climate change is one of the driving issues, of course. We have to get together as a community, express our public will that we want to create a better future for our grandchildren. So again, we as you said, we plant trees for now and work toward that future where the climate won't be changing by 5 or 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit.
Hmm. In the chapter titled simply Salmon, you tell us about the poetry and mystery and beauty of the Salmon Run. And I scarcely know where to begin. I mean, we really have to just leave it to our listeners to explore this chapter on their own to just learn so much about these fascinating and beautiful creatures. Maybe you could take up one of the questions that you raise, even though these are questions for which I don't believe there's a definitive answer. For instance, why do salmon move from saltwater to freshwater to breed? Or why do they breed only once before dying? Do we know the answer to either of those questions?
Not definitively, but it is absolutely remarkable. You'll be out in the... So salmon breed from Northern California up to Alaska in the Arctic, across, it used to be extremely abundant, Northern Europe and the Maritime provinces in New England, and in the Pacific across to Siberia and Japan. So they're distributed all over the world, and sometimes the streams they use are tiny, like our Tarbo Creek is just a little thing, but and these creeks and rivers will be empty, no fish at all, and then all of a sudden, in our case at Tarbo Creek, it's usually November or early December, these gigantic 7, 8, sometimes 12-pound fish will show up, and they're bright red, they're just beautiful creatures, as you say, and it's almost magical. Like, what happened? All of a sudden, they're not there. You know, they weren't there for months and months and months. The creek was quiet, and all of a sudden, here they are. And then, as you say, they go into this frenzy of building nests and mating, and 2 weeks later, they're dead. It's a remarkable thing to watch.
Hmm. It's also in this book that, in this chapter, I should say, that you talk about something that we sometimes hear about called the tragedy of the commons. And that is something that is demonstrated so clearly and really almost tragically when it comes to over-harvesting of fish all around the world. Remind our listeners what tragedy of the commons refers to and how that plays out when it comes to the way fish are harvested in so many places on the planet.
Well, that expression drew out of the analogy of when European settlers were settling in New England, they would establish commons, a public area for pasturing. And the tragedy of the commons is that because it was communally owned, no one was individually responsible for it. And so if someone put a lot of sheep, a lot of cattle on it, they might benefit because their animals are gaining weight and for market. But if they put too many on, the whole pasture will degrade for everyone else. But the individual will benefit even though everyone else's well-being is suffering. That is the tragedy of the commons. And as you said, it's played out in fisheries all over the world. I've just been reading a history of salmon and exploitation of salmon in the province of British Columbia. And as you said, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I've heard the expression, the multitude of these fish was inconceivable. There were so many salmon originally when Europeans and whites were first developing these fisheries that people couldn't believe it. And people kept saying, oh, they're inexhaustible, which a lot of your listeners may know is what people said about what were called the Lake States forests in Wisconsin and Michigan and in Minnesota, that they were inexhaustible. So the cutting started, and three decades later, they were gone. In some cases, those forests haven't recovered. Again, a tragedy of the commons, where if we've been careful about managing things and said, well, let's divide up these rivers and have regulations that are sensible for how many fish you can take, or in the case of forestry in the Midwest, how many trees you can cut per acre, you know, per season, all of us would have been a lot better off, but that's not what happened. People had this, you know, if I grab as much as I can, as fast as I can, you know, I'll make money and this other guy won't, and that's how things are working right now, so here we go. And all of a sudden the salmon are gone, the forests are gone, and we're left a generation or two later thinking, what happened? You know, why did you guys do that?
Right.
The world would have been better if we'd been a little more careful.
Obviously, yes. In the chapter called Blood, Sweat, and Tears, you take up the vexing problem of invasive species. And you pose, you know, first of all, kind of the intriguing point that only a small fraction of exotic plants, something like 10 to 15%, become invasive. And why it is that those few that become invasive is kind of an intriguing question and challenge. One of the things you also say is that invasives are so entrenched that eliminating them altogether is all but impossible. So how would you have us approach invasives?
Well, it's funny you should mention invasives. I woke up this morning, as I said earlier, we were out planting yesterday, and I didn't know it at the time, but I must have tangled with a Himalayan blackberry, because I woke up this morning, looked in the mirror, and I've got a big scratch on my cheek from one of its thorns. So this is one of the plants that has taken off locally, and I mentioned reed canary grass being a big scourge in the Midwest. So some of these, as you said, a few of the plants or animals that get imported from, in our case, overseas, take off. And the research that's been done suggests that the reason they can take off and start taking over huge swaths of area habitat is because only a few individuals are coming over when they're initially introduced. They don't bring over all the pests and diseases and bacteria and pathogens and that usually victimize them in their native area. So usually they have to cope with a bunch of diseases like any plant or animal on the planet. Their that browse them or viruses that can make them sick. So these invasives, without all those pests, have a lot of essentially time and energy that they can spend just growing. And so they will take over whole areas. And so initially, restoration would say, we've got to get rid of them. You know, they're taking over areas, they're beating back the native plants that we're trying to restore. And now everyone's realizing that, you know what, they're a fact of life. We've got to manage them, and they're going to be here. The idea of eliminating them is just completely impractical. So people have kind of changed. As you said, we have to learn to kind of live with them and figure out how to manage. Again, we can't go back. We have to work toward a future, and we're making it up as we go along. We have to figure it out.
Hmm. In the chapter called A Working Forest, you describe this patch of forest that was created in memory of Carl Leopold. And it's beautiful to see all that you have done to try to make this a working forest in every sense of the word. I want you to briefly explain one thing about this memorial forest, the fact that somebody might look at it, especially friends of yours from Europe who are used to different kinds of forests, and would look at it and think it was a mess. In what way is this memorial forest a mess, but the most beautiful kind of mess?
Yeah, I think if you understand how woods works, you understand that the mess is really productive for wildlife and soil. So after Susan's dad died, after Carl died, he'd inspired so much of who we try to be. We were able to purchase some of the forest land that you just mentioned, but we didn't want it to be a museum. We wanted it to be a working forest. So we do selective logging out there and are starting a little business to market products out of that forest. But the mess part is that part of the management plan that we created for this forest is that when a tree falls down, you know, wind blown or insect ridden or whatever, we'll leave it on the ground. We don't clean it up the way that a lot of forests, the way forests are managed in Japan or Germany, where it looks, really just clean, like somebody had vacuumed the interior. We try to create some of the natural, what you'd call structure in the forest, even though it is a working forest and we are doing some logging and so forth. We want to balance those values of, well, we can get a steady stream of income that's going to help our family and the local community, but we also want to create a place that's going to be productive for wildlife and build good soils over time and support a variety of species. So again, one of these balancing acts where you think we can do both. It's not either or.
In the last chapter of the book called A Natural Life, you explore what it means to live in true harmony with and in understanding of the earth. And you suggest four kind of modern-day beatitudes for someone who wants to live this sort of beautiful natural life: be engaged, be simple, be real, and be present. A closing thought from you on how you have managed to live this natural life in the area around beautiful Tarbu Creek?
Well, it's an aspiration. Like anything else in life, it's something we work on. It's always a process. But it's to me, it's a response to, again, being bombarded with all these messages about to be a good person, you have to buy a lot of stuff. You know, fundamentally, it doesn't work for us as human beings. What really is rewarding to us, what really makes us happy, is each other. And my favorite quote from Aldo Leopold is he wrote at one point, he said, the two things that are important to me, there are two things important to me in life. One is the relationship of people to each other, and the other is the relationship of people to the land. And so my idea of this natural life is when you really focus your life and what you do and how you conduct yourself, even, you know, decisions you make in the grocery store are, and in your work, is if you center it around those two things, what's the quality of my relationships with my friends and family and what I'm contributing to the community and your relationship to the land around you? You know, can you hunt or fish or grow some of your own food or help out on a weekend when people are pulling invasive plants and planting some native trees or prairie plants? To me, that really brings quality to life, and it makes us happy. You know, as I said, we were out planting shrubs yesterday in the cold, and everyone was having a great time. People didn't want to go home. It was really a lovely time and lovely group of people. And I think we carry those values forward, we'll be, I think, as a group, a lot happier.
Mm-hmm. The book is Saving Tarboog Creek, One Family's Quest to Heal the Land, published by Timber Press, the author, Scott Freeman. Scott Freeman, thank you so much for writing this beautiful, fascinating, and inspiring book.
Thank you, Greg. Great to talk with you today.
This is WGTD